Today on Renewing Your Mind.
God in His providence exercises His sovereignty over, in, and through all things. All things that come to pass in this world ultimately come to pass through the sovereign agency of God Himself.
Believers should understand, embrace, and love the doctrine of God's sovereignty. It's the great joy of a Christian to know that all things are in His hands. They're being used for His purposes and for our good. Today on Renewing Your Mind, Dr. R.C. Sproul returns to his verse-by-verse sermon series in the book of Romans, and we will see that all glory belongs to God.
Tonight we come to the last verse of chapter 11, which is the last verse of Paul's unfolding of the gospel of God. He concludes this section of his epistle with these words, "For of Him and through Him and to Him are all things, to whom be glory forever. Amen." There is in this single verse the sum and substance of the whole biblical revelation of the being and character of God. Paul sets it forth with the succinct use of three prepositions, which prepositions are virtually loaded with significance. That he says of God, "For of Him, through Him, and to Him are all things." And I'd like to spend a little bit of time tonight looking at those three prepositions and what they teach us about the nature of God. We can say by way of introduction that in summary, the apostle, by using these prepositions, is saying that God is the source and owner of everything that is. Second, He is the ultimate cause of everything that comes to pass, which comes to pass by means of the exercise of His sovereign will, and that God is not only the means of all things, but that He is the end or the purpose of all things. So all things begin with God, are governed by God, are used by God for the purpose of glorifying God. Now, first, let's look at the preposition that all things are of Him. The word here in the Greek is a simple preposition that can be interpreted or translated by the English word of or the English word from. There is a distinction that may be made between these two renditions. Both renditions, of course, call attention to a profound truth about God. Everything is of God in the sense that it is ultimately His. It is His possession. We remember that in the very first chapter of Romans, we saw that when Paul introduced himself as the author of this epistle, he talked about his credential as an apostle, having been set apart by the grace of God to and for the gospel of God. And if you remember way back when we started this study, I pointed out that the words there, the gospel of God, do not mean the good news about God, but that it was a possessive genitive meaning, that it was God's gospel. That what we have been studying throughout our attention to Romans is God's message. He is its source. He is its author. But now Paul is expanding that God is not simply the owner of the gospel. He's not simply the owner of this world, but that He owns everything in it. The cattle on 1,000 hills are His, and the rest of the cattle as well. And we could add to that the sheep and the donkeys, the camels, automobiles, homes, and the whole of creation. This is our Father's world. But beyond this obvious element of God's ownership of all things, we also see that as the owner, he is the source of everything. Now, in what does that consist? Well, of course, the very first affirmation about God in Genesis 1 is that he is the source of the universe. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And so this preposition here calls attention to God as the source of creation and everything in it. Now, back in the 18th century, when philosophers were very much concerned about the science of epistemology, which is the science of how we know anything, they wrestled at great length with the whole question that was asked to Jesus by Pontius Pilate. You recall, during his trial, Pilate said to Jesus, "What is truth?" But that's the question that philosophers through the ages have tried to answer, and certainly came to a heightened intensity in the 18th century. And at that point, John Locke was famous for introducing what was called the correspondence theory of truth. Quite simply, as the term indicates, the correspondence theory of truth says this: truth is that which corresponds to reality. However, no sooner had Locke laid the groundwork for the definition of the correspondence of truth than the next generation of philosophers began to talk about the way in which our individual perceptions determine our understanding of what truth is. And so the question was raised, if truth is that which corresponds to reality, what if my perception of reality is different from yours? And so the Christian response to that is what? Truth is that which corresponds to reality as it is perceived by God. Let me say it again. Truth is that which corresponds to reality as it is perceived by God. Beloved, only God has a comprehensive knowledge of all reality. God knows reality in its absolute fullness. There is no nuance, no microscopic subatomic particle of the universe that is unknown to the mind of God. What he knows perfectly. What he knows eternally. What he knows comprehensively. What he knows exhaustively. And this one who knows all things without error is the source of all truth. But not only is God the source in the Bible of truth, but he is the source and standard of goodness. The ultimate norm, the norm above all norms and without norm for ethics and for righteousness is the character of God himself. You see, how can we discern between that which is good and that which is evil? We look to the law of God to reveal to us the source of what is right, the source of what is evil. But the law of God is not some arbitrary legislation that God decides to impose upon his creatures. Rather, the law of God flows from his own being. In fact, we make a distinction in theology between the internal righteousness of God and the external righteousness of God. The external righteousness of God refers to what God does in his management of the universe. It refers to God's behavior, in which it says there's no shadow of turning in him, that his acts, that his works are altogether righteous. But the reason for the external righteousness of God is because the external righteousness of God flows out of the internal being of God. God does what is right because he is the source of all righteousness. And when God behaves in a righteous way, he's simply working out his own being, which is altogether righteous. He is the source of all that is good. He is the standard for all that is good. We are told in the Old Testament to worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. If you want to get an education that may rock your boat, go through the Old Testament and look up every passage that refers to beauty. And we will see that the Bible teaches that God is not only the wellspring, the fountain, and the source of the true and of the good, but he is also the wellspring, the source, and the standard of the beautiful. Everything that is beautiful comes from him. And everything that is beautiful in this world points back to him. Even pagans, when they compose magnificent music or art, they may in their own hearts have no affection for God, but in spite of themselves, the fruit of their labor points to the author and the source and the fountain of everything beautiful. There's nothing virtuous in the ugly. But here Paul is exclaiming that of him and from him are all things. And in our brief time tonight, I've just mentioned three things of which he's the source: the good, the true, and the beautiful. But we could expand that list far greatly if time permitted. Instead, if you'll allow me, I'll go to the next preposition. For of him and through him are all things. We believe that one sentence, through him are all things, that would end the Arminian Calvinistic debate forever. Because this text speaks about the means by which God governs and orders his universe. That word through has to do with means, with the instrument by which things come to pass. And Paul is simply reiterating here what he taught in Romans 8, that God in his providence exercises his sovereignty over, in, and through all things that come to pass in this world ultimately come to pass through the sovereign agency of God himself. We need to understand that. We need to embrace it, and we need to love it, because that is the great joy of the Christian, to know that all things are in his hand and are being used by him for his purposes through his causal means to bring to pass whatsoever he is pleased to bring to pass. There are no accidents in a universe governed by God in an ultimate sense. But when Paul comes to the end of his meditation on what God hath wrought through creation and through the redemption that he has brought to pass in and through Jesus Christ, after he sings this glorious doxology that we looked at last week, he sums it all up. For of him and through him, by his agency, by his means, are some things new, are all things. And finally, the third preposition, for of him and through him and to him. That is, that the word to here points to the purpose, to the end, where everything is moving. If I can end a sentence with a preposition, it's where everything is going to. So where is everything going? Where are all things headed? What is the goal of all of the universe? What is the ultimate purpose of all of history? In a word, the answer is God. He's the Alpha. He's the Omega. He's the source, the beginning. He's the end. All things are moving in history and in the universe to fulfill the purpose of God. Now, there are many things that we observe every day, and we look at it and we say, how in the world could that possibly fit in with the purposes of God? There's so much evil, so much corruption, so many things that we say God cannot have anything to do with this. But over against all that is wicked, all that is corrupt, all that is fallen, stands a mighty God who orders all things together to His glory. One theologian said that this last verse of chapter 11 is Paul's version of the non nobis domini. Not unto us, O Lord, not unto us, but unto thy name be all the glory. Your destiny has been appointed by God from the foundation of the world for His glory. The destiny of nations, the destiny of history, the destiny of planets, the orbiting of the heavenly bodies have been created, designed, and ordained of God to be used to display His glory. That's why the psalmist looks at the stars and is overcome with awe when he says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows forth His glory as well. And so he says, for of Him, through Him, and to Him are all things. To whom? Now we have a pronoun. To whom? Refers back to God. To whom be glory. Glory. Again, let me just give a brief excursus. I know you've heard me talk about this in the past. But that word for glory in the Bible is a glorious word. The word for glory, kavod or kabod, literally means God's weightiness, God's significance, God's value. Or as I mentioned indirectly this morning, God's august being and character. The glory of God refers to His singular transcendent dignity that no creature can possess in similar magnitude. God's glory is sui generis. It is in a class by itself. No creaturely thing is worthy to be compared with it. And when God, who shows forth this internal, weighty significance of His being, does it typically in the Old Testament as well as in the New Testament by the outward manifestation of the Shekinah cloud, that is so brilliant in its refulgence, so excellent in its brilliance, that human beings must shield their eyes from it, lest they would go blind. That is the outward manifestation of the eternal inward dignity of God. You know, one of the things all I have to do is mention it in a sermon or refer to it in passing, and my wife immediately tears up when we look at the description of the new heavens and the new earth at the final chapters of the book of Revelation. When it talks about the holy city that comes down out of heaven it is strangely described as a place where the sun doesn't shine. There aren't any candles. There's no moon. No artificial sources of light. You would think that any place like that would be a place that would be bathed in perpetual darkness. But what the author of the Revelation tells us is that there's no need of a sun or of artificial light in heaven, because the glory of God and the radiance of His Son bathes the holy city in light 24 hours a day. The glow from the face of God illumines every inch of the kingdom of heaven. That is a manifestation of His glory. You know, when we're finished with the service tonight, one of the last things we'll do, while most of us are in the parking lot, the deacons will stay behind, and they'll go about the sanctuary, and they'll extinguish all these candles. And they'll turn the lights out, because we don't need them anymore. And this room will be plunged into darkness, because even the light that we're enjoying in this room this evening, dear friends, is but for an hour or so. But the light of the glory of God is never extinguished. And the apostle says, to whom be glory forever. The glory of God is destined for eternity. It began in eternity, and it continues for eternity. Every Sunday morning in our bulletins, we include on the cross on the front page the five solas of the Reformation: sola scriptura, sola fide, sola gratia, solus Christus, and the final one, soli Deo gloria. The reason for that is that when Paul finishes the unfolding of the doctrines of grace that he has expounded in Romans chapters 1 through 11, he concludes his doxology with sola Deo gloria. To God alone the glory. Do you realize what kind of being we have to do with God? Do you realize why the only appropriate response when we enter into His presence, when we come into worship before Him, is the response of reverence? A response of awe. A response of humility. Of a response of submission. I think the thing that drives me crazy about the contemporary church is the cavalier casualness that professing Christians display in worship. Have they no idea of Him with whom they have to do? Where the angels themselves have to cover their eyes while they sing of His glory? The people of God are to be people of reverence and people of worship. For our glory will come and go, but the glory of God endures forever.
A sermon like that leaves you speechless, doesn't it? There are really no words that express the perfection, the majesty, the goodness of God. You're listening to Renewing Your Mind on this Sunday as we continue Dr. R.C. Sproul's series from the Book of Romans. Each Lord's Day, we return to this series, a 59-sermon, verse-by-verse exposition of Paul's most theologically rich book. We've learned a great deal so far, and I hope you'll make plans to join us every Sunday as we continue this series. You're welcome to contact us today and request the series. We've placed all 59 sermons onto a single USB drive, and when you give a donation of any amount, we will send it to you. Make your request at renewingyourmind.org. This is an online offer only, and that web address again is renewingyourmind.org. Well, as many of you know, the name of this program came from Romans chapter 12. And next week, Dr. Sproul turns to that chapter. We will discover what it means to have our minds renewed and to be a living sacrifice. So we hope you'll join us next Sunday here for Renewing Your Mind.